Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Franz de Waal is a distinguished primatologist, university professor, and author who specializes in primate social behavior. For years, he has been bucking prevailing notions about the nature of human morality and ethics. Over decades of research, he has found evidence of altruistic and empathic behavior in a number of species, concluding that there is a biological foundation for human morality that emerged from our animal origins. For a long time, de Waal's findings were ignored or dismissed by those who believe that ethics and altruism are cultural inventions that must be imposed on our brutish natures. The tide has turned, however, and the question is no longer whether animals have empathy, but how it works. Franz de Waal's latest book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates, provides evidence that the roots of human social behavior can be observed in other animals and addresses the persistent question of whether humans are ethical by nature. Franz de Waal, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be there.
So let's talk a little bit about the thinking that has been handed down for us for generations, what you call the veneer theory. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, the view of human nature was very bleak, especially in the 70s and 80s, where we had selfish genes and we had selfish psychologists, and we would never do anything for somebody else without some sort of calculation of what the benefits are. That was the view. And also in the domain of aggression, we were aggressive by nature. And as soon as people actually kill each other, we call them animals, because that's our animal nature is aggressive. And our human nature is, of course, noble and enriching and so on. And so that was sort of the view at the time. And I call it veneer theory, because basically it assumes that we are, at the core, we are nasty creatures like many other creatures. And we have a little veneer of culture or religion or morality over that. But as soon as you scratch that veneer away, that our true nature comes through. And I've always objected to that view, because I've always felt that, yes, we have aggressive tendencies. No one is going to deny that. But we also have completely different tendencies, like very positive ones and altruistic ones and empathic ones. And that was a sort of forgotten in that whole scheme. And now we live in a time where we are actually getting very interested in that side of human nature.
The idea being that humans are potentially but not naturally moral, and we must curb our base instincts and summon our better angels to live in civilization. Where did that come from? Is that a religious belief?
In the end, it's a religious belief. It's the original Finn-type thinking. That we got that into biology. It was not Darwin's idea. Darwin himself believed that there was a continuity between human morality and animal social instincts, as he called it. And so he had no trouble recognizing that kind of tendencies in other animals. But it's especially after World War II, when everyone got so obsessed with aggression, which was logical given the situation, I think, but people got so obsessed by it that all these very cynical theories about human nature came along. Mm.
Now, in your research in this area, you identify the pillars of morality to be reciprocity and empathy. So let's dig into that a little. Empathy is the main part of your research. You find examples, elephants, squirrels, other species showing empathy. Now, how is that measured and how is it expressed?
Well, empathy at its basis is that you have an emotional connection. So sometimes people think empathy must be very complicated, and that's for a long time why we assumed that only humans had it, because it was a very cognitive view of me putting myself in your shoes or something like that. But actually the basis of empathy is that you are emotionally connected to somebody else, and that emotional connection you can see in many animals. So the reason we have dogs and cats at home and not iguanas and snakes most of the time is because dogs and cats are emotionally connected to us. They're mammals, and all the mammals have that basic connection. And so that's the empathy connection. And once you develop a bigger brain like we do, you can use that connection also to translate it into cognitive things like me imagining how you feel. But that's really not how it got started.
And how about reciprocity? How has that been demonstrated in populations that you studied?
Well, we study, for example, reciprocity in our chimpanzees by introducing food in the middle of the day that they can share, like big watermelons that they can break apart and they can share it with each other. But in the morning, we have measured who grooms whom for how long. And then we connect the two. And then you find that if I have groomed you for half an hour in the morning, I have a much better chance of getting some of your food later in the afternoon. And so that's the reciprocity thing that goes on in chimpanzees, and they have very good memories for it. And so if I support you in a fight, for example, that's even more important, I think, than grooming, and that will certainly give big payoffs.
But that is not calculating behavior, figuring that, well, if I groom you, I'll get more food later.
No, we don't know that. So for many animals, because the same sort of thing happens in some monkey species, for many animals we assume that it is not based on me predicting what you will do later on in the day. Also, I cannot predict that you will have food later on in the day, because that's an unpredictable assignment, so to speak. And so we usually assume that there are certain positive tendencies like grooming and food sharing and so on that are going on, but they connect through memory and through emotions. But calculating this, that's more like in human business where I give you a present in order to get you as a client in my restaurant or something like
that.
I think humans do that kind of calculations, but much of our reciprocity is not like that. And actually, if I'm too calculating, if let's say in close relationships like with my brothers or with my wife and so on, I would be doing things in order to get benefits, we would see that as a bad sign, actually.
How about when there are limits to this pro-social behavior, when empathy and altruism get tested and become conflict? Your observations of chimpanzees and bonobos observe reconciliation after a fight. Mm-hmm. What would motivate reconciliation?
Well, I think reconciliation is related to the value of relationships. And so there's many studies on the primates. So, for example, chimps, they kiss and embrace after a fight. Bonobos, they may have sex after a fight. And there's many studies where we have looked at in which relationships and under what circumstances does this happen. And usually it is between individuals who need each other one way or another. There could be a mother and son, or it could be two coalition partners who help each other in fights all the time, so more like a political connection. I actually watch the primaries here in the U.S. always with interest, because the primaries are between candidates of the same party, and they have a big fight, but they need to reconcile in the end. And I always wait for that moment, because once, let's say, Bush has defeated McCain, the two need to make up, otherwise the party is going to fall apart. And so I'm always interested in these reconciliations between politicians, because they are an illustration of that principle, that the more valuable the relationships, the more you're going to get reconciliation.
And, of course, that leads to survival, that kind of pro-social behavior, that the party stays intact and moves on.
Yeah, and that's true for all the things that I described for my primates, is they in the end, they serve survival. That doesn't mean that the actors themselves, at the moment that they do these things like food sharing or grooming or reconciling, that they realize how important it is. But the reason we have these behavioral tendencies is because in the end it's good for our relationships and our survival.
We're speaking with the primatologist Frans de Waal about the biological roots of morality. This is something that he has observed in many different species of animals. He works primarily with bonobos and chimpanzees. His latest book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among Primates. Other experiments that you worked with showed that there is a sense of fairness, or what economists call inequity aversion, observed in capuchin monkeys in this case. Can you describe a little of that experiment for our radio listeners?
Yeah, that experiment became very popular because we put a little video on the internet that you can look up. If you look up capuchins and fairness, you'll probably find it. And what we did in that experiment is we put two capuchins who normally live in a larger group, but we put them in a test chamber side by side, and we have them do a very simple task. And if you give them the same reward, let's say you give them both grapes or you give them both cucumber or both apple, they will perform many times in a row without any problems. But now if you give them unequal rewards, so cucumber is very low on the list for capuchin monkeys, if you give one of them grapes and the other one cucumber, then the one who gets cucumber after one or two of these trials starts to give up and gets angry and agitated and may throw the cucumber away and starts to hit the cage and so on and doesn't want to perform anymore, which is a very strange response, of course, given that if both get cucumber, they will do it 25 times in a row. And so we call that inequity aversion. It's the first sign of fairness. It's basically the Wall Street protest, I call it, because basically this monkey is unhappy about the bonuses that the other one is getting. That's what it comes down to.
You identify evidence of social animals or social pro-social behavior among animals and humans, but you distinguish from self-sacrificing behavior that is found in some species. So some exercise morality and others do not. Can you distinguish that for us?
Well, I think morality has to do with keeping a society together despite conflict. So human morality is very often aimed at the community level and what is good for our society rather than what is good for me as an individual, even though my individual survival is tied up with the society. And so that's what morality usually works on enhancing cooperation. And I'm not sure that I would call a chimpanzee a moral being, because there are certain aspects to human morality that I don't see with them. But the basic social tendencies that you need to have to become a moral being, they are present. But morality deals sometimes with nasty behavior, sometimes with friendly behavior. So usually human morality discourages nasty behavior and encourages positive behavior, but it's not always the case. We also punish, for example, in our moral systems. And so that's a negative behavior that we have, is that if you do something wrong, we're going to punish you.
I'd love to get a little bit to your title, The Atheist and the Bonobo. Now, you identify yourself, as a person who is not a man of faith, but unlike a lot of prominent atheists that I have read and observed recently, there's no desire to disprove the presence of God or belief in God. Elaborate on that idea that religion does not necessarily have the monopoly on morality. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. The way I look at morality is that it's older than our religions, certainly than our current religions. And so a religion like Christianity cannot claim to have installed morality in humans, because I'm sure that 100,000 years ago, long before Christianity came along, humans were interested in social rules and in fairness and in empathy and so on. And so I think moral systems were in place, and the religions may have adopted them and may have started strengthening certain aspects of it, and they may have played a role in that. And I don't deny that religion may play a constructive role in this. My view on the neo-atheists that we've had over the last few years is that they are too obsessed with proving or disproving God, which to me is a totally futile enterprise, because who's ever going to prove or disprove God? That's something that scientists should not really be occupied with. And my question is more like, we all have religion in the world. All human societies have religion and believe in the supernatural. Why is that? And why do we have these religions? What is their interaction with morality? Do they strengthen it? Do they weaken it? Those are interesting questions to me. And the question whether God exists or not is, for me, not an interesting question.
Mm. After many decades of forming this view that the natural world is not a brutal place necessary, where living things are all scratching and clawing their way through their short lives to the top, how does this change your view of humanity?
Well, I've usually a view of humanity is that it's full of good intentions and it has quite a potential of positive and constructive behavior, even though, of course, sometimes things derail and you get a clash between two groups where one tries to exterminate the other. And so I'm not denying that there is competition and aggression, but we have had a tendency, let's say that way, we've had a tendency to overemphasize the aggressive and nasty side, which like in the daily news, we pay attention to all the things that go wrong in the city. But there's a lot of things that go right in the city, and we don't pay attention to that. And that's a bit what happened to science, I think. We got so obsessed by these negative behaviors that we can observe in our species that we forgot that there's an enormous potential for cooperation and positive behavior also.
Franz de Waal, a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Franz de Waal is a primatologist and professor of primate behavior at Emory University. We spoke with him today about his most recent book. He has written several. This one, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. We have a link to read more about the book and also to see that wonderful video of the capuchin monkeys at wordofmouthradio.org. Bonobos are known as the make-love-not-war species of the ape lineage and for their strong sense of community. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to hear about a test of that old saying about communal life. Good fences make for good neighbors. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the old adage goes, good fences make for good neighbors. But what happens if that barrier disappears? Here's a story of two neighbors, their fence, and what happened when it all came tumbling down.
My name is Mackenzie Yamamura, and this is my fence.
My name is Scott Bray, and we're in my backyard, and this is my fence.
The fence between their yards is sturdy. It's made of redwood or some other wood.
It's not going anywhere. You don't hear any creaking, shaking. It's a totally solid fence.
But it wasn't always that way. Their last fence was old and weak. And then on New Year's Day a few years back, a powerful storm swept in.
Water got into the ground. It got saturated and the fence posts were rotten out.
And I hear this just loud, booming sound.
Looked out here one day and it fell down. That was it. It was over.
The neighbors didn't fix it right away. It was down for months.
Pretty much a clear path between our yards. Just wide open.
I think it was probably,
you could kind of see, you know, his little patio.
Like 15 or 20 feet, 20-foot section of fence that was just down. And so it's pretty tacky, pretty trashy looking. It didn't bother me that much because I wasn't having people over that much. But
I remember we had a Mother's Day brunch here, and we didn't have a fence or anything. So, you know, of course, I tried to let Scott know, you know, we're going to have people, our mothers out on the patio. And I think we even rolled out our ping pong table to kind of like create some sort of little barrier. So, you know, to create some privacy a little bit.
Honestly, when they would be doing something out here, I would try to stay in my house to give them their privacy. It's embarrassing. I mean, if they're over there, you know, having a barbecue and I'm out here, you know, cleaning up dog poop, it's not very appetizing, I guess.
Yeah, it was awkward, but it wasn't all bad. They had sort of this backyard bond. They were sharing a private space. It was somehow more intimate than talking to a neighbor in the front yard.
The fence being gone, you know, forced us to kind of be involved in some way with each other's lives.
I mean, you can't, it's not like you can go out in your yards and you're like just a few feet from each other and you can't acknowledge each other. I guess you could, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Scott would be out mowing the lawn. We're like, hey, neighbor, how's it going? And Scott would have his shirt off. He'd be like doing his yard work and we just chat and share a beer, you know, once in a while. And it just felt like we kind of knew what was going on in his life, but without feeling like we were really invading each other's privacy.
7 months and several shared beers later, the neighbors finally got around to rebuilding their fence. And then, almost immediately, that friendly dynamic changed. They went back to being just neighbors.
I don't know if you noticed, my garage is back here behind my house, and my driveway is primarily behind my house, so I can get in and out of my home. I use the back door almost exclusively, so you know, if I time it right, I don't have to talk to anybody.
I just can't tell when he's home, really, because I don't see his car, and his hours maybe are a little different than ours.
It's weird, because the fence is a weird thing, because I know when they're back there, and I know they know when I'm back here. It's not like, I mean, you can see movement through the cracks, you know, and you can hear things.
I don't just like peer over and chat with him. It would just feel kind of funny to start a conversation between the fence. So even though sometimes I know he's there, I just don't talk to him as much. And it's very rare to kind of run into him just casually.
And it turns out Scott actually prefers to keep to himself.
Are you glad to have the fence back?
Yeah, yeah. I might have put the, try to squeeze the planks closer together because there's big gaps between them. But it's okay. It's fine.
That story was produced by Tamara Keith. Word of Mouth continues with more from NHPR's higher education series, A Matter of Degrees. David McCullough Jr. will join me to talk about his new book, You Are Not Special. He explains why he thinks today's college-bound students need to be allowed to fail. That's after the headlines from NHPR.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It was the high school commencement address heard round the world.
You're not special. You're not exceptional. Contrary to what your U9 soccer trophy suggests, you're... Your glowing seventh grade report card, despite every assurance of a certain corpulent purple dinosaur, that nice Mr. Rogers, and your batty Aunt Sylvia, no matter how often your paternal caped crusader has swooped in to save you, you are nothing special.
English teacher David McCullough Jr. there, addressing the 2012 graduates from the public high school in Wellesley, Massachusetts. A video of that speech went hyper-viral, and within days, he was on TV and radio from Berlin to Beijing. It was discussed by pundits and from pulpits. People stopped him on the street to praise him. A few encouraged him to run for office. Suddenly, he writes, I was the you are not special guy. David McCullough Jr. expands on that fateful speech in a new book called You Are Not Special and Other Encouragements. With a wry, affectionate eye, he addresses the role that parents and communities and educators play in the drive to excel. Now, as we're discussing the State of Higher Education series this week on NHPR's A Matter of Degrees, we look to the college students of tomorrow, that coddled generation of kids, micromanaged by their parents and raised to believe that they are exceptional. David McCullough Jr., welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
When you delivered that speech, you had 26 years of teaching then under your belt, first in Hawaii and then in Wellesley. When did you begin to observe parents becoming, as you put it, the CFOs, strategic planners, marketing directors, and chauffeurs to their kids?
I started to see a little bit in the later years in Hawaii and then quite overwhelmingly in Wellesley, where I teach, and in Sudbury, where I live. It's a different culture with different expectations, and well-meaning parents are quite involved in every aspect of their children's lives.
Well-meaning parents, you're a parent yourself, you have four kids, and you write about this overwhelming urge to secure or to aid in their safety and happiness. But you also write about the deeper meaning of the helicopter phenomenon. What do you think parents are working out here?
I think all of us are struggling to define what is best for our child and what our role in achieving that might be. To what degree do you allow your child self-determination, come what may? And to what degree do you stride along with them and make sure outcomes work out the way they should? It's a difficult balance to strike.
The idea that we hear from you in the speech and in the book is that kids need the latitude to screw up. But given such high stakes, and especially our conventional ideas about, success is assured if you get into the right school, why not actively steer kids whose judgment and whose neurological makeup is still unformed?
For that very reason. They were denying them the experience to navigate, negotiate life on their own. And in school, the stakes should be low, not so high that parents need to intercede all the time. schooled is the ideal place where a kid can encounter struggle. Kids need to fail. They just shouldn't think themselves failures for having done so. And if parents deny kids wobbles, they're denying them the experience of dealing with wobbles, of picking themselves up off the ground after something doesn't quite go their way.
How do you think the opposite of that manifests for kids? We have a very me-centered generation, believing that success is a mandate for them. How does that affect the way that they think about themselves and the world?
Well, because so much has been dedicated to their success, they think being self-involved is being responsible. They don't think of themselves as narcissistic or solipsistic or self-involved. They think they're just being normal because this is the way people behave. They're in constant communication with one another all the time. To me, the selfie is a lovely metaphor for our era. From the parenting point of view, I think the perfect metaphor for our era is the car seat. You know, kids are protected, they're driven, and they're aimed in one direction. But their perspective is limited, their freedom is inhibited. Yes, they're safe, absolutely. But, you know, they're looking at the back of the seat in front. They can hardly see out the window. And that denies them, in my view, very important formative experiences.
David McCullough Jr. is with us. He's out with a new book called You're Not Special and Other Encouragements, which addresses, among other things, the cult of exceptionalism, with teenagers ever more preoccupied with success and ever more frightened of taking risks. So what you're talking about, David, throughout this book, you know, you address parents, you address teachers, you address students themselves, is taking down or disrupting, as the language is now in education and business, a whole system overloaded based on cutthroat competition. How do you do that? How do you take down this whole system?
You know, it's a statistical inevitability that most of us are average. The problem is success entails being above average. So how do you accomplish that then? Well, you inflate grades, and so upward grades creep. It's an inflated economy from every angle. It's also an arms race. Kids are competing for admission to what they'll call, quote, good colleges, which is code for prestigious colleges. And they know that's accomplished with terrific grades. And terrific grades are achieved by choosing courses in which you know you're likeliest to succeed, which from the educator's point of view is less than ideal.
Well, this is something that you mentioned noticing in Sudbury, where you live, and the town of Wellesley, associated, I think, in many of our minds with wealth and exclusivity. I mean, these kids, we think, are born on third base. So how do you encourage them to think independently? Tell us about some of the tactics that you use in class and other ways to address that idea of daring to take a risk.
I try to give them experiences at which they will not succeed. I give them sometimes very difficult assignments that they're going to do poorly on. And I try to show them, look, it's okay not to do well. Sometimes when I give pop quizzes, I will tell them, if you did well, don't gloat. If you did poorly, don't despair. I think that's important. I need, as a parent and as a teacher, to disabuse the notion that school is about grades. It's not. It's about education.
Do you advise some of these kids to, you know, forget spending $54,000 on college, go to the library for 4 years, rebuild a 68 Mustang, you know, go to Port-au-Prince and work in a clinic? Now, ironically, these are exactly the kind of verifiable hours of dedicated altruism or experience that admissions officers are looking for on college admissions.
I don't envy college admissions officers. They have a very, very difficult job to perform. Kids have the notion that if they attain a certain GPA and a certain SAT score, and they have an impressive enough resume, they should, by all rights, get into any college they want. What they don't understand is that college admissions officers are building a mosaic, which is as it should be. They want fully dimensional, invested, interesting people who are going to thrive on their particular campus. In my view, high school should not be about getting ready for college. High school should be about igniting interests and rewarding enthusiasm and learning a beneficial skill set and having fun growing.
We meet a number of kids in your book. One of them is Max.
He's a mm-hmm. bagger at a local grocery store, and he's one of these kids kind of caught in the middle. He's slightly embarrassed that he's working as at the grocery store, but he tells you that his parents make too much money for him to get much financial aid and not enough to comfortably send him. It was shocking to read that a lot of these kids perceive underprivilege, you know, the lack of expectations, as having freedom. Where does the middle class fit into this?
Yes, kids who come from a family with means enough to send them to college, but not enough to pay for it comfortably, and have too much to qualify for financial aid, are in a very difficult spot. College is hugely expensive, as of course you know.
So what is at stake here, David McCullough Jr., if we don't put the brakes on this arms race for heading in one direction, you know, the track of success, the attention of the college admissions officers, the conspicuous achievement? What happens if we don't stop this?
The danger is that we're going to create underprepared, needy, fragile people who will be of little benefit to the rest of us. Education is about the students' growth, of course, but it's also about how the rest of us will benefit from the good work of the educated person. And so it matters to all of us what's happening. It should matter to all of us.
Well, David McCullough, much more than the You're Not Special guy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You're kind. Thank you.
David McCullough Jr., public high school teacher, whose 2012 commencement address was viewed and debated the world over. His new book is called You Are Not Special and Other Encouragements. You can learn a lot more about the book and watch the speech at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is staying on the education beat, this time with a story that takes us outside the classroom and into hackerspace, tinkering as a teaching tool. That's after the break. This is Word of Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In recent years, the maker movement, which includes do-it-yourselfers and high-tech hackers, has been introducing an even younger generation to the joys of making things with their own hands. And slowly, adult hacker spaces have been reaching out to young people. What's more, we're seeing a rise of youth groups called Hacker Scouts and DIY clubs. Reporter John Kalish tells us about this grassroots movement that is now teaching kids science, technology, engineering, and math hands-on. Outside the classroom.
A small group of kids and parents are gathered in a community garden in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. This monthly meeting of the DIY Club is happening thanks to a children's website called DIY.org. Today the kids are making seed bombs, little balls of compost soil and clay with seeds inside them. Little Trixie Rapp, who also makes her own animated films and fake poop from cardboard, she is 10 years old after all, is full of scientific observations about the garden she's helping to grow.
I think the slug is actually a pest because, like, it nibbles on all of the plants that you plant, I guess. We keep finding baby slugs, and they just look like a dot of jello.
Photos and videos of Trixie's projects are displayed on several pages of the DIY.org website, where she goes by the name Kooky Cat. Her audience is huge. For a fifth grader, 75,000 kids are registered with DIY.org, which is headquartered in San Francisco. The Bay Area is a hotbed of DIY culture. No surprise, then, that a new organization called Hacker Scouts started here. Hacker Scouts is geared towards children between the ages of 8 and 14. And like the DIY Club in Brooklyn, it's co-ed. About a dozen kids sit at a large work table using glue guns to make little cars out of popsicle sticks, plastic straws, and other materials. The passengers in these tiny vehicles are hard-boiled eggs, which sometimes survive a trip down a steep incline.
Go, guys!
Hey, nice.
And sometimes not.
There's no right or wrong way to do it.
Lance Akiyama runs an after-school program called the Workshop for Young Engineers.
experientially, they're learning things like momentum and crashworthiness, resilience, those sorts of things.
We're filling a hole. This kind of education was missing.
Samantha Cook is a mother of three and the executive director of Hacker Scouts.
We can give kids a really grounded education in STEAM, so science, technology, engineering, art, and math. And we can highly individualize it. So we have these concepts and skills that we're presenting, but every single time they come to us, there is a way to individualize it, to make it personal, to make it relevant to their own life.
Here in Oakland, 11-year-old Gigi Mancusa-Jackson is demonstrating a little robot that resembles a mouse. She soldered it together from a kit. Her mom, Rebecca, says Gigi loves to make things with her hands.
Most recently, she made a bed.
And PVC pipe. PVC pipe and a tarp. And then you just put an air mattress on top.
She makes everything by herself since she was four. So this is ideal for her because she has people here who can help her with these things that I can't help her with.
People like Shoshana Abras, who's a member of the hackerspace where the Hacker Scouts meet. She makes her own jewelry when she's not working as a site reliability engineer at Google.
What I'm doing now was not even thought of in school when I was their age. It was not even taught in college. It's still not taught in college, really. That's the environment these kids are going to be growing up into. They're going to be doing things that we can't even imagine now with technologies that haven't been invented. So that's what they have to learn, that sense of fearlessness, to touch technology, to explore it for themselves.
In addition to the knowledgeable mentors at Hacker Scouts, kids have access to expensive computer-controlled fabrication gear, tools that are key in 21st century manufacturing. 11-year-old Annabelle Costello waits to have some cardboard cut on a $9,000 laser cutter.
Since I'm making a desk, I don't want to waste a whole bunch of wood if I mess up. So I need to do a prototype with cardboard that's half size. And I just built all the pieces on my computer.
When Annabelle says she built the pieces of the desk on her computer, she really means she created the digital blueprints for them with computer-aided design, or CAD, software. In Hacker Scouts, an 11-year-old is taught how to use CAD. When it's time to cut her desk parts out of plywood, a grown-up will do it, operating a $15,000 computer-controlled router. It's there because the Oakland chapter of Hacker Scouts meets at Ace Monster Toys, which, despite its name, is an adult hackerspace. The original Hacker Scouts chapter in Oakland has a waiting list of 60 kids who want to join. In addition to the Oakland chapter, there are close to 24 affiliates around the country that are either up and running or starting in the fall. Over at the children's website, DIY.org in San Francisco, about half of the 80-plus skills kids are encouraged to master involve STEM. Zach Klein, a former Eagle Scout who went on to co-found Vimeo, is DIY.org's CEO.
It seems to be a whole new era of what it's possible for kids to be learning, and schools aren't bridging that gap, and it's just creating demand for organizations like ours to give kids the tools and communities they need to make progress on their own.
Close to 100 DIY clubs, including a new one in Portland, Oregon, are affiliated with the website. Once kids master a skill, they get a virtual merit badge posted on their webpage. They'll be able to get embroidered versions of these colorful hexagonal patches in the mail later this summer. Back at the DIY club in Brooklyn, 10-year-old Trixie Rapp says she's looking forward to the patches she's earned, which include gardener, animator, and prankster, for making that fake poop.
I'm just going to put them all on my hoodie and backpacks and stuff.
Some people say the DIY movement is a throwback to a time when people made more things themselves. But as DIY.org's Zach Klein suggested, it may well be the future. Do-it-yourself learning, bridging the gap between formal education and the desire to be creative outside of school. I'm John Kalish.
Tinkering and scout hacking are novel ways to teach young kids about the STEM subjects. At the collegiate level, there are courses that take unorthodox approaches to core subjects a step further. Here's a case in point.
Hi, I'm Afia Ofori-Mensa, and I teach a course called How to Win a Beauty Pageant at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. Oh, she is, Miss I think the educational value of studying beauty pageants lies in the fact that people can connect to them in some kinds of ways, but at the same time, they're foreign. They happen every year. Thousands of them happen in the United States alone. They happen all over the world.
Our first runner-up to Miss Africa USA.
Contestant number 24, Yoshiki Sindal.
How do you feel? Salamat sa mga kababayan ko. Mahal na mahal ko.
But they're also unusual. In some ways, it's like a subculture. It's not something that everybody does. It's not something that everybody has done. But I have found almost always somebody says, oh, my cousin was in one, or my sister used to do those, or I used to do them.
When I'm not at work in elderly care, I love to volunteer at my local cat shelter as I have an obsession with cats. An interesting fact about me is I am the first Miss Gibraltar of Moroccan descent, which just goes to show what a beautiful, cultural, diverse country Gibraltar is.
When you talk about the titles of beauty pageants, like Miss America or something like that, there's a suggestion written into the title that this person is supposed to be a representative of a whole national group of people. And so if that's the case, we should be able to watch how that person changes over time, which is to say, who are the different winners year after year after year? And that can tell us something about how the nation, too, is changing over time, and tell us also something about ideals of femininity and how ideals of femininity tie into ideals of nationhood.
Women's roles in the U.S. have changed dramatically since the 1960s. What changes would you like to see next?
Well, I'd like to see changes as far as women also, well, like President Clinton is doing, he's getting a lot of women in the House of Representatives. I think that also,
Sorry, well, relax. Take a second.
That first time that I taught it at the University of Michigan, there was this mid-semester evaluation process that we did there. And one piece of feedback said, I felt like the title was misleading. And that seemed to suggest to me that someone had actually taken the class hoping that they would learn the steps and tools for how to win a beauty pageant, which was shocking to me because it was a 300-level American culture seminar.
Mallory, you have been a phenomenal Miss America. Are you ready to pass on the crown?
I am. It's time.
We do readings by scholars who have actually written specifically about beauty pageants. So Miss America, Japanese-American Nisei Week Queen pageants, Miss Fine Brown Frame in African-American communities in the 1940s. And so we do readings about those throughout the semester, coupled with theoretical readings that teach students about things like intersectionality, performativity, and how gender is constructed, and all these kinds of things. In addition to that, there's one capstone assignment centered on a field visit to the Miss Gay America drag pageant, female impersonation pageant.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 34th annual Miss Gay America pageant.
They write field notes about that pageant, and then they write an essay based on those field notes and on the various readings that we've done in the course.
Coveted spots. Now at this time, please join us as we celebrate our 34-year history by welcoming to the stage Miss Gay America 1973, Norma Christie.
A lot of things that I say, like on the first day when we're reading the syllabus and that kind of stuff, suggest that this class is not going to be an easy class. Word gets around very quickly that I'm not an easy professor to take a class from. To some extent, I don't even have to do that work anymore. The reputation does it for me.
That was Assistant Professor Afia Ofori-Mensa from Oberlin College discussing her course, How to Win a Beauty Pageant, Race, Gender, Culture, and U.S. National Identity. We've just scratched the surface of interesting college courses. Tomorrow, we'll hear from a professor who is teaching a class on zombies in popular media. That is one that I would like to audit from afar. From offbeat course offerings to the NCAA athletes' rights movements, we're going to be covering a number of aspects of higher education as part of NHPR's week-long series, A Matter of Degrees. You can find links to listen to all these stories or pass them around at nhpr.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We will be back tomorrow with more word of mouth at 2 o'clock right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.